Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. Ed Bish was working at his office in Philadelphia in 2001 when he got a frantic call from his daughter. It was about his son, Eddie.
She said, "Dad, Eddie's not breathing and he's turning blue."
He told her to call 911, and then he raced home to figure out what was happening.
Ran outside. Jumped in the cab. I was only 15 minutes away.
Eddie was a senior in high school at the time, a pretty good soccer player. His favorite hobby was cooking. He had big dreams of becoming a chef. He'd already been accepted to attend culinary school after graduation. When Ed finally arrived at his house, he was met by two medics sitting in the back of their ambulance. His son was not inside the vehicle.
And they looked at me and they just said, "Sorry, sir." And I was like, "Don't tell me he's dead." And they said, "Sorry, sir, nothing we could do." I let out a scream. I ran in the house. My brother was there. He stopped me from running up steps. And, you know, what? What happened?
Ed was in total shock. He had no idea what could have caused his son's death.
And about 5-10 minutes, some of Eddie's friends were outside. I go outside. I was like, tell me what he did. I knew he was in a party the night before. I was like, tell me what he did. They said, "An oxy." What the hell's an oxy?
Oxy is short for OxyContin, a brand name of oxycodone. It's a semi-synthetic opioid used to treat pain. By now, it's infamous for being highly addictive. OxyContin is supposed to be swallowed whole with water. But as Ed found out later, Eddie had chewed the pill. That altered the drug's time-release mechanism, causing his blood to absorb the dose rapidly. Then he drank alcohol and apparently took some benzodiazepines. He died in his sleep.
And I went back in the house and I had my head down on the table crying. And a police sergeant came in and he said, "OxyContin? Kids are dying left and right from this stuff." I popped right up. I was like, "What?"
It was the first time Ed Bish had ever heard of Oxy, but cases like his son's were happening all over the country.
So right then and there, hopped on the internet, started to do research.
OxyContin had been approved by the FDA in 1996, and it was wreaking havoc. Kids and adults were getting their hands on it, either at the doctor's office or on the street, and they were overdosing on this drug, dying. Ed was overwhelmed with grief, but determined to do something about this crisis.
And I think I knew right then and there, I needed to warn everybody about this new drug that's killing kids. My son was in high school. 2001, high school kids didn't die. I mean, it was just like total shock.
He began to connect with other families whose loved ones had overdosed on the drug, become addicted to it, or who had been prescribed the painkiller and then started using heroin. Together with some other parents, he created a group called Relatives Against Purdue Pharma. Purdue is the company that manufactures OxyContin and has now been embroiled in lawsuits for years. I asked him what he's learned about being an activist.
"You better pack a lunch. Because it's very, very frustrating. It takes time. It should never take in the government so many years to really address OxyContin. But after like 15 years, they started to really address it. Maybe if it wasn't for people like myself, maybe it would have been 20 years. And the way I look at it, if people like me don't speak out, who's going to speak out?" the goal of everybody who've lost their kid. They don't want others to go through the same because it's a lifelong nightmare. You have a before and after. Something like this tragedy happens to you, nothing's ever the same. And the sun never shines as brightly. The music never plays as lovely. But you have to go on. You have to learn how to live with it. Helping others for myself and many others helps us heal a little.
The opioid epidemic continues to claim lives every day, and it has left a wake of grief and sadness in communities all over the country. Everywhere, people like Ed Bish are propelled into activism, working to prevent more deaths and helping those who've become addicted. On this episode, the people on the front lines are fighting the opioid crisis, trying to find solutions one person at a time. Ed's story, along with many others, has been documented by journalist Beth Macy. She's been covering the effects of drug addiction on communities across the U.S. for over two decades. The limited-run series Dopesick on Hulu, starring Michael Keaton, is based on her 2018 best-selling book of the same title.
I know most people don't think about us up there in the mountains. Many of my patients are minors. It's dangerous work, and they carry the burden of building this nation on their backs. They're in pain. These people, my people, trusted me. I can't believe how many of them are dead now.
We've begun looking at something that could be big.
OxyContin.
Purdue Pharma, they've been marketing the drug as something that's not addictive, when it clearly is.
Dopesick was about the root causes of the opioid epidemic and the lives that have been impacted by it. Beth's latest book documents the work of people on the ground who are trying to address this crisis using an approach called harm reduction. Her book is called Raising Lazarus: Hope, Justice, and the Future of America's Overdose Crisis. And I wanted to ask you about the title, because when I first saw the title somewhere, I initially thought, oh, I wonder if this is a book about Narcan, because I thought of Lazarus as rising from the dead. But then as I read your book, I realized you use the image or the story of Lazarus in a different way. Why did you choose this title?
Yeah, the title was really inspired by the Reverend Michelle Mathis, who leads the nation's first queer, biracial, faith-based harm reduction group out of a small town called Hickory, North Carolina. And what she does, and what I witnessed her doing over and over, is when she's speaking to a community group, particularly of, quote, Christians, and she's trying to get them to embrace that harm reduction in the round works, she will tell the story of Jesus performing the miracle of bringing Lazarus back to the living, but that it was the disciples that had to do the dirty work of rolling the stone so he could come out and then unbinding the dirty burial cloths. And what she says to these groups, and she's really trying to get them to check their own blind spots, she says, this is messy, dirty, smelly work, and you might get a little bit of stink on you, but only by getting close to Lazarus, or i.e. the person who needs your help in who's suffering from opioid use disorder, only by getting close will you experience the miracle of raising Lazarus. And that's just so true, because the people I know who are the helpers in this book, when they have a win with somebody, there is just nothing like it. And I've seen that over and over again, whether it's an emergency room doctor or a judge that begins thinking differently, or a community leader, when they start to see positive results, then they all want to become these stone rollers, as I call them in the book.
So the stone rollers in Beth's book practice harm reduction, an approach that first became popular during the AIDS epidemic with clean needle exchanges to stop the transmission of the virus, and has expanded from there.
It's this idea of meeting people without judgment, even if they're still using, because we know that so many of them have been let down by the systems that were supposed to protect them or supposed to help them get care, that they've been very stigmatized, particularly by healthcare providers. And we know we have to initially meet them in use with clean needles, fentanyl test strips, Narcan. And once the little threads of trust begin to be built, then ideally they are more likely to seek treatment. We know that people that go to needle exchanges, for instance, are 5 times more likely to seek treatment and 3 times more likely to stop using drugs, period.
The book starts next to a dumpster in a parking lot with a man called Tim Nolan, who is just trying everything he can to reach people. Who is Tim? What is he doing?
Tim is a nurse practitioner, and he's been doing street medicine, as he refers to it, since the 80s, going back to deinstitutionalization in Washington, D.C., and he did a lot of work with AIDS patients in New York in the 90s. And he sees his work in harm reduction with people who are addicted in the same vein, an extension of what he was doing prior. And he works all day with people who are addicted or people who have HIV or AIDS in a federally qualified health center. But at night, he volunteers for Michelle Mathis's harm reduction group, Olive Branch. And he began by passing out needles at truck stops. And this is a real rural region in North Carolina. And he noticed that the people who were getting needles, many of them were saying they were sick with hepatitis C, but they hadn't been tested or treated. So he said, maybe they, and this is harm reduction too, he said, maybe they're not ready to start recovery yet, but they all want their hep C treated because it makes them feel really badly. I mean, he has people on his needle exchange route who are now hosting hepatitis C testing parties in their homes. And then they're more likely to come to him and want to be put on what he calls low threshold or low barrier buprenorphine.
Buprenorphine is a medication used to treat opioid use disorder. It lowers the effects of withdrawal symptoms and cravings. And Tim Nolan tries to get people on this medication and into treatment, like the patient he was meeting by the dumpster.
The guy's been injecting for more than 10 years. He's been in and out of jail. He's about to lose his job because of his addiction, and he's crying. He's high. He says, you know, if I don't get off the needle, I'm going to die. And Tim tells him two important things, and this is why I started with that anecdote. He says, one, you can get better. He didn't think he could. And in fact, most Americans have just written off this population. Most Americans don't think they can get better. And two, and this is key, don't disappear. And that's back to this idea that even if you're still using, I'm going to get you on this discount, low barrier buprenorphine to staunch the cravings. But even if you relapse this week or go back to use, even with something else, still meet me.
So even if you, quote, mess up, unquote,
yeah,
I'll still be here waiting for you.
Yeah. Sometimes they relapse and they're afraid he's going to be disappointed in them because he's made this strong relationship. And so they stop answering their phones. Almost everybody has a cell phone, even people who are unhoused. And so he can usually get them, or he knows their cousin who he also treats, and they'll kind of tell him where they are. And he's going to track you down. He's like, I'm going to her damn house if I have to.
Beth said a lot of the services she saw that made a real difference weren't all that complicated.
They're high touch and low tech. I mean, if somebody has a phone, they should be able to call somebody for help with this. And, you know, that's why I do a big section on the woman that runs the front desk at his clinic, because she is a certified peer, but she chooses to run the front desk because that first contact with somebody who's coming in for treatment, maybe they've been in use for 7 years. This peer, her name is Nicole, wants this new patient to feel embraced. So she immediately says, I'm in recovery too, before the person's even volunteered it, you know, because mm-hmm. you can kind of tell. I give a talk to healthcare providers a lot, and I have a picture of Nicole manning the front desk. And above it, I wrote 3 words, just be nice.
Beth says kindness wins the day, even small gestures.
I talked to a guy who runs a needle exchange in Jamestown, New York, and he had been a heroin user in New York City in the 90s. And he said the first time he went into one, the person at the front desk said, how can I help you? And he said, I'm hungry. I need a sandwich. And she gave me a sandwich. And that sandwich, you know, led to da-da-da-da-da-da. Now he has a master's degree and he runs a harm reduction center. It's not that big a leap, but it's just, are we willing to treat people with kindness at that initial interaction? Because these folks have been so beaten down.
I wanted to ask you about the difference between harm reduction in different parts of the country. You know, I live in Philadelphia. I've been here for a long time. Needle exchanges have been around as long as I can remember. Mm-hmm. They've been sort of part of the fabric of what is done around here. Mm-hmm. But in some of the communities you profile, this was a big fight.
Absolutely. The most shocking story to me as I was following this book was the fact that Charleston, West Virginia, so West Virginia is the state with the highest overdose death rate, was in the middle of an HIV spike, mm-hmm. Which the CDC pronounced as the most concerning in the nation. And the needle exchange at the time was run by the health department. This is 2018, and people were complaining about people congregating, and it was near the fancy downtown mall. That was an issue, and they were reporting needle litter. And rather than dispatch people to address those issues, they shut it down. And then the state legislature there passed a really restrictive law. They mandated you had to have ID. Well, what homeless person still has their ID? And two, it was a one-for-one exchange. And that just wasn't doable for the populations. And then in places like Charleston, a lot of it's just happening underground now.
And some of the people you profile in the book also use different methods depending on what was legal and what wasn't. I'm thinking about Michelle Mathis, for example. Didn't they used to stuff needles into food packages?
Yeah, they started a food pantry, and they really thought it was going to be a food pantry in 2009 out of the back of their pickup truck, she and her wife, Karen. And they shortly realized that about half of the folks that were coming for food were using IV drugs. So then they would, they said Nature's Valley granola boxes were particularly handy for, they would take out half the granola bars and put needles in, and they put a piece of tape on the end, which would be their tell. You know, they didn't want to give them just granola bars, and they didn't want to give somebody who didn't use granola bars with needles. And so that sort of developed. And then, you know, Michelle is really known for being sort of grandmotherly and motherly and has really good relationships with law enforcement. And so by the time needle exchange in North Carolina was legalized, and I think that was 2016, she was poised to, like, kind of become official and went to the police chief in her town. He said, "We're good. That's all I need to know. And I know you'll run it right." It's trickier in communities where the law enforcement maybe hasn't been educated yet. And the thing I liked about Michelle and the reason I wanted to write about her is because unlike most harm reductionists I had met from the cities were just like kind of casting law enforcement as unnecessary and unwoke. And Michelle said, no, if we're really going to make change, we have to educate them and we have to meet them where they are too.
Beth Macy is a journalist. She's based in Virginia. Her latest book is called Raising Lazarus: Hope, Justice, and the Future of America's Overdose Crisis. We're talking about harm reduction and the people who are fighting to save lives one person at a time. Coming up, we'll meet a woman who gives out Narcan to everyone, and that includes even the people who are selling drugs.
Where he asked me for Narcan. So I drop it off on his porch. It's like the strangest relationship you could ever have with a person. But so I'm like his Narcan dealer.
That's still to come on The Pulse.
The Commonwealth Fund supports The Pulse and reporting on health equity. The Commonwealth Fund, affordable quality healthcare for everyone.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about the opioid epidemic and harm reduction, which is an approach to help people who are addicted by meeting them where they're at. Some of the latest data from 2021 shows that more than 75,000 people died from an opioid overdose in a 12-month period. In many parts of the country, Narcan, an opioid antidote, has become readily available as a way to prevent overdose deaths. First, it was given out to only a few selected people, but increasingly it's being distributed widely. Basically, the thinking is the more people who carry Narcan, the better. For one woman, that means even the people who are selling drugs should have Narcan available. A few years ago, reporter Nina Feldman followed this volunteer outreach worker as she was making her rounds, checking on people and handing out Narcan. This volunteer lives in a Philadelphia neighborhood that's been hit especially hard by the opioid epidemic.
I hate trash day because you don't know if that's a bag or a person. You see, over there.
Rosalind Pichardo grew up here. After she lost two siblings to gun violence, she started an organization that supports other families who lost loved ones. But over time, she noticed that gun violence was not the only epidemic plaguing the streets of her neighborhood. One day, she was giving out food to people who were homeless when she saw someone overdose.
And I'm like, well, what? That guy is blue. Can somebody help me out? Is he choking on something? Like, I had no idea. Like, I was kind of naive. I knew people did drugs around here, but I didn't know what an overdose looked like. I just didn't know.
This was happening everywhere. People were dying at alarming rates. So when she found out there was a drug that could reverse overdoses, she started giving out as much as she could.
You guys go with Narcan? Y'all need Narcan or anything?
Roz calls the people she helps her sunshines.
Sunshine!
She says she wanted a word besides addict or any of the other negative terms used for people who use drugs. There wasn't really a good alternative, so she sort of made one up.
Sunshine, where your coat at?
Roz loaded up a bag full of snacks and unused syringes and Narcan and hit the streets. On the day I went out with her while she made her rounds, the first person we saw was her cousin.
You got Narcan on you, right?
I need one.
You need one?
He had a couple of nasty-looking wounds on his arm that she wanted to check on.
Oh, no.
Is it closed up?
Yeah, closed up and it's flattened out.
She gave him a packaged cake, some clean socks, and some Narcan to keep on hand.
I wish he wasn't out here. How long has he been out here?
A couple years.
I just reversed on that too long ago.
Oh, really?
Roz doesn't just give out Narcan. She also uses it. A lot. She's reversed hundreds of overdoses herself. She keeps track of them in a little black book she keeps in her fanny pack. There was one particular reversal that Roz says changed the way she thought about who she should hand out Narcan to. Roz saw a guy overdosing in front of a line of people waiting for free samples from a drug dealer.
So I run to the guy, and he was completely blue and unresponsive, and the dealer was still handing out samples while the guy is like, oh, damn. And I remember calling, grabbing my phone and saying I need to call 911. And him pulling out a 9mm and saying to me, what are you doing? And I said, I have to call the paramedics because this guy is dying and I only have one Narcan. So he put the gun to my face and said, no, you're not going to call because I'm not done handing out these samples. And I said, well, can you at least help me roll him? And he kicked him on his side and rolled the guy, like using his foot.
Roz was paralyzed with fear. She didn't know whether to leave and get more Narcan and come back or what.
And thankfully, the guy came to and he was okay. So then I went back and a couple days later and gave the dealer Narcan.
To be clear, she's talking about the guy who just held a gun to her head.
Now we're semi-friends, where he asked me for Narcan. So I drop it off on his porch. It's like the strangest relationship you could ever have with a person. But yeah, it's like, it's insane.
He has her number and texts her when he runs out, and she drops a bunch of doses off at his house.
So I'm like his Narcan dealer, I guess.
I asked Roz if she would connect me with him. She reached out, but he wasn't interested in talking to a reporter.
Yo!
After that, when she took to the streets, Roz didn't just hand out Narcan to people using drugs. She thought she might as well offer it to people dealing, too.
If they're going to be selling their stuff, they could at least carry Narcan. I mean, if they're business savvy, they definitely want their customers coming back, right?
If this idea seems kind of fringe, well, so did the notion that drug users would ever carry Narcan themselves. Naloxone was approved by the FDA to reverse opioid overdoses in 1971, but it was really only used by doctors and paramedics for the next 20 years. Starting in the late 80s, during the height of the HIV epidemic, syringe exchanges started preventing many people who use drugs from contracting HIV. That meant the bigger threat was overdosing.
People are living longer, but they happen to be dying of overdose rather than dying of HIV.
Nancy Campbell is a researcher at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute who wrote a book about the history of naloxone. She says it wasn't until syringe exchanges proved successful that people started thinking about shifting naloxone out of the medical realm and into the hands of people using drugs. After a decades-long battle, naloxone is now pretty mainstream. Public health departments distribute naloxone and train people how to use it. Roz has no trouble giving out naloxone to people who use drugs, but the dealers can be a bit more skeptical. So she has a whole strategy for how to approach them. Like any good plan, it revolves around snacks.
I normally carry like Oreos and stuff with people. It's hard to say no.
She starts out by offering food to her sunshines. She says that signals to people that she's an outreach worker and she's there to help. Then she'll offer snacks to the dealers.
Some of them will take it and then I say, well, I have Narcan. Do you carry Narcan? And then that's when some will say yes, some will say no. So the ones who said no, I guarantee that maybe by next week they'll carry it. I'm going to go back and, you know, give some more Oreos and give them my spiel on why they need to carry Narcan.
The day we went out, Roz said she didn't recognize a lot of the faces. She says that happens when police do sweeps and arrest people. A new crew crops up to take their place. It's easier to offer Narcan to people she knows from around. Still, sometimes the new people go for it. For Roz, whether she's talking to someone using drugs or selling drugs, her goal is the same.
It's always been in my mind to kind of meet people exactly where they are. I'm not trying to change anybody. I'm just trying to make people smile for a moment. And I think I do that a lot.
Still, the work is emotionally draining. She relies on her faith to get her through. The little book Roz carries with her to track the overdoses she's reversed is actually a pocket-sized Bible. Across the thin pages and fine print, she's jotted the rough demographic information for each person she's saved in Sharpie.
So this one's another one, 7/12/2019, male in his 60s, 12/30, two Narcans, Kensington and Somerset, and he went to the hospital, stamp name with Venom.
Roz wants to pray for the people whose lives she's saving, but that doesn't always feel appropriate.
Hovering over somebody trying to pray for somebody, thinking about like, lady, you crazy. So I'm like, I just get the little book and just write it in. It's pocket size. And you don't even have to know you're praying for them. Just write in the book. And that'll be my way of praying. Even though I don't like get on my hands and knees or nothing. I'm like, okay, I wrote you in the book. Jesus got you. And that's it. I don't need to say a prayer because they're already in the book.
As usual, she's just trying to meet people where they are.
That story was reported by Nina Feldman. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Journalist Beth Macy has been writing about the opioid epidemic for years. Her best-selling book, Dope Sick, has been turned into a mini-series. I talked to her about her latest book, Raising Lazarus, which follows people who are trying to help those who are addicted in very grassroots ways. From your research in this book and meeting all the people that you met, what do you think are the biggest barriers to getting people into any form of treatment or getting them started on a path toward recovery? What stands in the way the most?
Well, I think it's financial. So I think a great thing would be to make the buprenorphine or methadone treatments accessible, like on demand, and free.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's going to pay for itself eventually when you see these people starting to get their lives back together. So I think our health departments, our federally qualified health centers, I mean, I think that and Narcan are kind of low-hanging fruit. We know it works. There's so much research about buprenorphine helping folks.
So again, buprenorphine is a medication used to treat addiction. It's also an opioid medication, but it has less potential for abuse and helps people manage withdrawal symptoms and cravings. So right now, if somebody wants to get on this kind of treatment, who pays for it or how do they get in?
Well, if they're in a Medicaid expansion state and they get on Medicaid, I mean, that's another thing. A lot of people qualify, but they haven't gone to the trouble to apply for it. If they've been living homeless and, you know, just doing what they can to get by, you should be able to get treatment at a federally qualified health center. But again, mm-hmm. you have to get there. That's why these low barrier, low threshold, and even walk-in clinics are so important. You know, we have around 20, a couple dozen walk-in centers in the whole nation. And I don't know if you remember in the history chapter where I go deep into the war on drugs, mm-hmm. back in the early 70s, when veterans were coming back from Vietnam addicted to heroin, President Nixon, this is before the drug war, but he tapped this guy to report directly to him, cabinet level position. His name was Dr. Jerome Jaffe, and he basically designed a walk-in clinic treatment center for methadone for veterans. And Nixon was doing it because he wanted points with veterans. And they also offered housing connections and social support. So that's, we've done it before. But, you know, during the Obama years, the drug czar position was demoted. It's no longer a cabinet level position. And I think our healthcare groups, I mean, I just think they need to step up. And what I say when I'm speaking to doctors is like, look, everybody participated in the system that helped get so many Americans addicted, and you ought to be willing to participate in the solution. And so right now, doctors still have to get waivered. They have to go through a training course and get a DEA license, special license to prescribe buprenorphine. I think they need to do away with the waiver altogether.
Is there any concern, fear, reluctance, just because here's another drug that's going to be prescribed by a doctor? So among people who were using drugs, are using, and got hooked on this from visiting another doctor, is there any fear there? Like, can I trust these people? Why can I trust them now when I couldn't trust them before?
Yeah, you hear that, but the research is just so clear. I mean, the World Health Organization, NIDA, the National Institutes of Drug Abuse, the CDC, they all say that buprenorphine should be the frontline treatment for opioid use disorder. It is ironic, but it's there. And like one of the best descriptions I've ever heard of just the absolute desperation people feel when they're hooked on opioids is that imagine you and I that we hadn't been able to eat food for 2 weeks, and then somebody puts a delicious plate of food in front of us and says, you can't eat that. You know, we would be so starving, and it's like the brain is starving for this medicine. And what the buprenorphine does is it stops that craving, stops that starvation, so that people can then begin to not start their day worrying about where they're going to get their drugs to, quote, get well for the day. It's they can worry about maybe where they're going to sleep instead, and maybe where they're going to work, and how they're going to get their kids back, and things that are better able to, you know, improve their lives. We've got to make the treatment easier to access than the dope, because it's just out there everywhere. It's so cheap, and it's, you know, it's so fentanyl infiltrated these days.
Now, you mentioned buprenorphine and you mentioned Narcan, or the lack of access to both. What are some other big issues that stand in the way of people getting the help they need when they are ready? So we're talking about people who are desperate, want to change, want to do something new, and yet it's like impossible to get there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why we need more Tims out there mm-hmm. driving around and helping people. We need more needle exchanges that people can not only walk in and get safe use kits and needles, but also can get connected to treatment and housing when they're ready. I talk about Huntington, West Virginia, which has this place where people can go. They can get signed up for Medicaid if they're not on it. They can get referred to housing if they don't have anywhere to live. And they can get on buprenorphine right there. You know, they can walk in and get the help they need without an appointment. You know, and this is the city that had 26 overdoses in one day back in 2016. As one person told me, everybody checked their egos in the door. We got to fix this. We're tired of being ground zero of the opioid epidemic.
How far did the pandemic set back this fight against the opioid epidemic? I mean, it seemed like the public's eyes went away from this crisis for the last 2 years. During that same time, we've seen more contamination with fentanyl. So where are we now?
Well, it just every time they tally the numbers, you know, they'll say like June, these were the numbers, and in August, these were the numbers for the past year. It goes up every time. You know, the last time I checked, it was 108,000 deaths for the last year. I think that was mostly 2021. And when you talk to the epidemiologists who are studying this, we've been on the rise since the late 80s for drug overdose deaths. And so often you'll see this number, we've lost over 500,000 to opioid overdoses. That's since 1999. When you actually tally it up and then you add the latest deaths, it's over 1 million. And it's predicted to double by 2029. So, I mean, we are at an emergency point with this, and we really, this is why I'm so glad the book comes out now, and it really is a book about how to make change in your community.
One of the criticisms of this approach is that it can seem like it's enabling people to continue behaviors that are harmful, potentially deadly, or even condoning drug use. For example, when communities debate opening a safe injection site where people can inject drugs under supervision to avoid fatal overdoses, many are appalled that money and resources would go toward a place like this. Some of the people who are doing harm reduction work, providing services, they are torn about these issues too, and it's hard for them. That's something journalist Beth Macy mentioned.
Yes, many, especially the peers, and that's a short for peer recovery specialist, a person in recovery who's been trained in how to reach people who are still in use and sort of walk them through the recovery journey. It's kind of ironic that the people most equipped to kind of help them and meet them where they are also the most vulnerable because, you know, especially in the pandemic, they were all working at the ragged edge of capacity and many of them relapsed.
So what's it really like on the front lines doing this work? Pulse reporter Marcus Biddle spent a few days with outreach workers in Philadelphia, and he has this profile of one of them.
Joe Quinn is 48 years old, 5'7", and has a thick Philly accent. People usually think he's Italian-American because of his black hair and tan skin tone, but he's actually Irish-American.
I'm very Philly. I live, breathe, sleep Philly. I don't like leaving the city much. If I do leave the city, it's for maybe 3 days at the most, and I'm back. I could care less of seeing in other places too much. It's like I go there, I see it, and it's like, all right, I seen it. I'm cool. I'd rather go back and go get a chicken sandwich from Tony Luke's.
Joe works for Pathways to Housing, an organization that finds homes or shelter for people, even if they're still using drugs. He started doing this work more than 10 years ago.
Because I see how this plays out. Usually you're going to kill yourself or end up in prison. Those are the two end results.
Joe's a peer specialist, which means he knows firsthand what he's talking about. He was a teenager when he first experimented with painkillers, and things quickly spiraled out of control into addiction. Soon he couldn't afford pills and switched to heroin. Those were dark times for Joe.
There's a lot of pain that comes along with it. Family don't talk to you. Friends that were childhood friends no longer talk to you. You're pretty much on your own. Just you and your addiction, and how am I getting through every single day? From the time you wake up to the time you go to sleep, it's just like, how am I surviving?
I met up with Joe in a Philly neighborhood called Kensington. It's been the epicenter of the opioid crisis in the city. You can't walk a mile without finding clusters of orange, inch-long syringe caps at a park, train stop, or on the sidewalk. They're everywhere. People shoot up in the open, sometimes in eyesight of police or children just walking to school. You find homeless groups encamped under parts of the train bridge, and trash usually carpets the sidewalk. Joe got into recovery 13 years ago. He used to work in construction, but after realizing he was living paycheck to paycheck to support his addiction, he decided to seek drug treatment, and he went a lot of times.
I lost count a long time ago. I was like a revolving door in and out of detoxes, rehabs. There's not a detox or rehab in the city I haven't been through. Most of them multiple times, to the point where there used to be a hospital on Girard Ave, St. Joe's Hospital, who had a detox floor. They knew me by first name basis every time I come in there. It was Joe's back.
He enrolled in a methadone program and volunteered at a church giving breakfast and clothes to the homeless on Saturday mornings. Something about that work changed him. He felt done with using.
There was just a feeling you have. It was like this calmness.
Joe decided to become a certified peer specialist in 2011. When he first heard of the term harm reduction, he wasn't exactly a believer.
It was just so out there. I believed it as being, I'm enabling this person. I'm being okay with his lifestyle.
When Joe got into recovery, harm reduction approaches hadn't really taken off yet. He had to get clean first to get more services, to stay on the path. But he says everything was different back then. The drugs themselves were not as deadly.
Before the fentanyl came, you could spend $20 on actual heroin. Do two $10 bags, and you would be fine till the next morning if you had to be, without experiencing any withdrawal symptoms.
And yes, people overdosed, but it wasn't like it is now. One common street drug today is called tranq, a sedative also known as xylazine, which is used to sedate animals. That's what people are injecting with heroin and fentanyl.
It's just eating the flesh to the point where there's like nothing on their arms. You can see all the way down to the tendons and to the point where they're getting their arms and their legs amputated.
And it's a trend that's spreading fast, faster than he can keep up with. That's because fentanyl mixed with heroin isn't strong enough anymore. It doesn't have legs, as Joe often hears.
Every 6 months, or 6 months to a year, the drugs just keep changing.
As newer drugs become more lethal, Joe's come around to the idea of harm reduction.
Most people don't want to die. Something as simple as that can be a game changer when it comes to someone living and dying.
It's about keeping people alive long enough to get treatment. At least, that's the hope.
People were dying so rapidly, the mind frame then went to, how can I keep him alive long enough so I can eventually have that conversation?
Joe is out there, offering services, checking up on people, making sure they're okay. But he's not demanding that they stop using. Sometimes he feels conflicted about meeting people where they're at, especially when someone overdoses. He has too many stories about that. He told me about one time where he was helping a young woman who he thought was ready to give up her addiction.
Sat with us for, I don't know, an hour and a half maybe, making plans. She was going to go to an NA meeting. I had some people I know down South Philly where she wanted to go. I got them on the phone. They agreed to meet her down there, so she knew some people at the meeting. And then she left the office, said she was going home to go sleep.
But Joe and others were worried about her.
One of the outreach workers calls the office and is like, something's not right. I'm calling her, she's not answering. Something's not right. I got a gut feeling. So we shot over there.
And when they got to her home, their worst fear came true. She was dead from an overdose. Those are the moments when Joe feels like he's contributing to the problem, not the solution. Harm reduction now goes beyond using Narcan or clean needles. These days, you have to be a little more creative than that. Take one strategy that Joe uses called staggered use. Think of it as a buddy system. Whatever happens, you never shoot up alone. Always do it with a friend, significant other, or group of people. The trick is to let people use one at a time. That way, if you're in danger of overdosing, someone is always there to give you Narcan or call 911. He used this approach with one couple that always used together, and the boyfriend would inject his girlfriend.
She could never get a hit herself.
But then the boyfriend left.
And he decided to pack up and leave the state, go back to their home state to get sober. She was stuck here on her own. She had no friends.
She tried to shoot herself up but couldn't. So Joe asked her to, without sticking herself, show him how she used her syringe. He had her flex to show where her veins popped up. They were very small, and he noticed that the syringe that she was using had a bigger gauge.
She was just jacking her arms up. And, I mean, they were so beat up and bruised. And she was getting these big, from all these abscesses from just missing shots. And it was hard to look at.
So he showed her different angles of how she could use her needles.
And from my experience, not to brag, I was a very good hit. When I was getting high, I bing, bang.
Within weeks, he noticed an improvement with her arms. And since she was alone, they came up with a different approach to the buddy system.
So she used to call me every single day and say, Joe, I'm about to get high. I'm in my apartment. If you don't hear from me in 15 minutes, call my phone. If I don't answer, call an ambulance.
Joe coaches people to use another tactic called the slow push. It pretty much sounds like what it is. Instead of just using the entire dosage of a syringe, you only inject half of it and wait 15 to 20 seconds to decide if you want to use the rest. You usually know if it's what you're used to using before. It avoids taking a full and potentially lethal dose of something like Trank. There are many days when this work takes a toll on Joe's own recovery. He feels conflicted about being in recovery himself and doing this work. It means he's around a lot of drug use that can lead to temptation and urge to start using again. He's had to frequently call his supervisor to leave certain situations.
This job can be very triggering. It can take you back there real easy, especially when you're out in the community in Kensington. You're walking the streets you used to cop on.
Whenever he hears about another person dying from an overdose, it feels like he's witnessing a part of his own past that could have been his reality. He works through these moments, keeps going with his work, and even though he occasionally feels conflicted about harm reduction, he says it achieves a different level of trust and being present with those struggling with addiction. It's something that Joe believes would have made a difference in his own life if someone had been there with him too.
That was Marcus Biddle reporting. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Marcus Biddle is our health equity fellow. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Nicole Curry is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.